What's the universe at time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. North Korea said today it had successfully test-fired a new type of medium to long-range ballistic missile Sunday, claiming further advancement in a weapons program it is pursuing in violation of UN resolutions. Meantime, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea have asked for an emergency session of the United Nations Security Council. Korea Economic Institute scholar Troy Stangeron on whether that meeting might produce anything new.
I would expect there to be a statement from the Council condemning the test, but I think it's unlikely that we see additional sanctions. Sanctions on North Korean missile tests tend to be related to things like their space launch, which are much more robust rockets than this.
North Korea fired the ballistic missile on a high projection into the Sea of Japan. First test of U.S. President Donald Trump's vow to get tough on Pyongyang that tested nuclear devices as well as ballistic missiles last year in an unprecedented rate. President Trump's senior policy advisor Stephen Miller says the White House is considering all options in an effort to upend a court ruling that froze Mr. Trump's order to ban travel from 7 majority Muslim countries. Mr. Trump says he's considering a new executive order on immigration, which could be signed as soon as today or Tuesday. He said such a move might be faster than defending his blocked executive order in a further court appeal. The parliament of the breakaway Republic of Somaliland has overwhelmingly approved a deal to allow the United Arab Emirates to establish an air and naval base in the port town of Berbera. In return, the UAE has signed to implement various development projects in Somaliland. This is VOA News. United Nations says last week's U.S. airstrikes in southern Afghanistan could have killed at least 18 civilians. The strikes targeted insurgent positions on Thursday and Friday in an embattled district in the province of Helmand. The Islamic insurgency launched a major offensive against the district 2 weeks ago and captured areas in and around the district's center. Afghan security forces backed by U.S. air support have been seen trying to evict the insurgents, and both sides have suffered heavy casualties. Turkey's president says his troops and allied Syrian opposition fighters have entered the center of the northern town of Al-Bab that is a stronghold of the Islamic State group.
Al-Bab şu anda hallolmak üzere. Şimdi bundan sonraki süreçte doğuya yönelip Münbiç ve
Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Al-Bab is being taken care of at the moment and the following will be toward the east, Manbij and Raqqa. The goal is to establish 4 to 5,000 square kilometers secure zone, he says, that has been cleared of terrorism. IS fighters have begun deserting Al-Bab, which had been under attack for weeks, Al-Bab 40 kilometers south of the Turkish border. British Defense Secretary Michael Fallon says he expects the Islamic State will be expelled from the towns and cities of Iraq this year, specifically Mosul.
I am delighted to see East Mosul now liberated and people returning to that city, and the operation to liberate West Mosul about to begin. And I congratulate the Iraqi forces and the Peshmerga on the role they have played in allowing the people of Mosul back to their homes to live in freedom again.
Fallon also said he expects operations to retake Raqqa in Syria are progressing. Fallon was on a visit to Baghdad and Erbil, meeting with Iraqi and Kurdish leaders and commanders of the coalition against IS. Britain is a member of that coalition and has contributed intelligence, air power, infantry training, and some of its special forces to the fight. Officials in the U.S. state of California have ordered tens of thousands of people to evacuate an area in the northern part of the state where a spillway at the tallest dam in the U.S. could fail. Focus of their concern is the Oroville Dam, where damage to the main spillway last week has been followed by weakness in an emergency spillway. And Adele's song Hello won the Song of the Year prize at the 59th Annual Grammy Awards in Los Angeles late Sunday. Get more news at the VOA mobile app.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, February 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A former African Union official shares his reflections after two terms as deputy chair.
Personally, I feel satisfied that as we leave an institution that is stronger, an institution that is got a lot of hope for the future, and a continent that, of course, has to achieve its dreams and aspirations.
Irasu Mwecha is the immediate past deputy chair of the African Union Commission. There has been yet another resignation from South Sudan President Salva Kiir's administration, and Lesotho's former prime minister returned home promising a legal overthrow of the current government.
Former prime minister cannot stay outside forever. He has to come back home because he has got his own party, which he is supposed to lead. And the nation is more confident that if he is around, there is possibility of change of government.
Samuel Nsekela is the Secretary General of the All Basotho Convention Party. Rights groups hailed a Kenya court decision blocking the closure of the Dadaab refugee camp. And in part two of our series on Boko Haram, we'll look at the anatomy of an attack. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley sports and our Black History Month facts and contests are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The immediate past deputy chairman of the African Union Commission says he feels satisfied that the administration he served in is leaving an African Union that is stronger and full of all sorts of hopes for the continent, despite its many challenges. Erastus Mwecha, who served two consecutive terms, 8 years, says he is proud the African Union has put in place a mechanism that allows the continent to be able to respond quickly whenever there is a threat. He says the AU should focus more on good governance because if it is to attain one of its aspirations, which is to silence all guns on the continent by 2020, Mwecha says most of the challenges facing Africa can be forestalled before they reach full-blown armed conflict if the continent had better governance. Mwecha spoke with me on a wide range of topics about the continent.
Personally, I feel satisfied that as we leave an institution that is stronger, an institution that is got a lot of hope for the future, and a continent that, of course, has to achieve its dreams and aspirations, particularly the challenges that we face in the continent of growth and employment, particularly for the youth.
Stronger. What do you think were some of the achievements of the administration you serve in, and what do you think are some of the drawbacks? Let's talk first about the achievements.
Well, on the side of achievements, if I start with the sector of peace and security, we have been able to put in place now and completed the architecture, an architecture that should be able to respond quickly when there is a challenge in the continent, an architecture that should also be able to support Africa's intervention, because one of the challenges we've had in the past is that Africa was not there when there was call for Africa's intervention and therefore others had to come in. Then, of course, looking at the economic sectors, I could start with the general growth of the economy. We have had unprecedented growth in terms of general economic growth of the continent. Although, unfortunately, right now as we speak, because of the falling commodity prices, our continent's growth is again affected. And so at the continent level, we have now a focused agenda, an agenda that is globally supported because we have now put in place our Agenda 2063. In the area of governance, and I guess this is perhaps a crucial one, one that I see should be the focus for the future, because one of the aspirations we have on the continent is to silence guns by 2020. Most of the challenges that we have in the continent is that if we had better governance, we can be able to forestall some of these conflicts before they reach into full-blown armed conflict.
Where are we now in terms of peacekeeping? Now that it seems to me some troop-contributing nations are threatening pull out of the peacekeeping mechanism?
Well, first of all, let me put the Somali issue in context. We firmly believe that we should implement our exit strategy as soon as possible, and we shouldn't be in Somalia more than when we are welcome. We're supporting Somalia to establish its own defense system, and in the long run, it is Somalia that should defend itself and take care of its own security. But in the transit period, we have had challenges of resources to be able to support peacekeeping operations. As African Union, we have over 40,000 men and women deployed out there. And a lot of resources that we use in keeping these forces active in theater is really given by our development partners. So the progress here is the African leaders have decided that we must contribute to peace and security situation in the continent and also peace missions that are authorized by the African Union to the tune of at least 40% of the cost of such missions.
You mentioned governance, the issue of, say, democracy in Africa. Somalia just had an election. Gambia also just had its election. We have the situation in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This year also Liberia will have its election. What can you say about progress in that area of democracy?
First of all, in general, let's look at the issue of elections before I go into other areas of governance. On average, we have about 15 to 20 elections in a year. And I must say, out of those, one would say overwhelming number of them go very well. There is still a small number of elections that have not performed as well as our expectations would be. And this has got to do mainly with weak institutions at the national level, whether it is the electoral law, whether it is the electoral commission that manages elections, or whether it is political parties themselves that are organized in a more democratic manner. And so these are areas where we have developed standards. And you can see that those countries that have domesticated these standards, those countries that are implementing it, you do have very successful elections.
Erastus Mwecha is the immediate past deputy chair of the African Union Commission. He was speaking with me from New Delhi, India. You can hear part two of his interview tomorrow on Daybreak Africa. Former Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane returned home yesterday from South Africa, where he has been under a self-imposed exile, vowing to legally overthrow the current government of Prime Minister Phakalita Musisili. Thabane fled the country in 2014 after alleging a conspiracy to kill him. Samuyane Nsekele is a secretary general of Mr. Thabane's All Basotho Convention Party. He says although the threat still remains, the former prime minister had to return home to lead his party, and also because the Basotho people believe there is a possibility of a change in government by his return.
After being out of the country for a period of 2 years, former prime minister is now back at home to lead his own party, which has got larger numbers in parliament. And he will be as a leader of opposition in parliament since now that the government has got no numbers.
Mr. Thabane said that the current prime minister must open parliament so that, quote, we can legally overthrow his government and take over. What does he mean by that?
When he's saying that, he means as opposition, they now have the greater number than the government in parliament. The current government is ruling with minority, which is a minority government. The position of the former prime minister is saying is like as opposition, together with our coalition and members in the opposition, we now have the greater number than that one of the government, indicating that the government is now ruling with its minority.
Mr. Thabane said he fled the country because his life was in danger. So now, is his life not in danger by returning?
Former Prime Minister cannot stay outside forever. He's still under security threat, but with no help, he has to come back home because he has got his own party, which he's supposed to lead. And the nation is more confident that if he's around, there is possibility of change of government. If he's around, he's going to save his own country.
Doesn't Mr. Thabane's return mean that Lesotho is going to be politically unstable again?
One can see that as such, because those who are losing power will get threatened. But the majority of Basotho are feeling relieved of his return because he's the person entrusted to lead this country for the betterment of everyone and the betterment of the economy of Lesotho. He doesn't tolerate corruption at all.
South Africa and SADC have been calling for peace and political reform in Lesotho. And during his self-imposed exile, Mr. Thabane lived in South Africa. Yet he seemed to be criticizing SADC's role in Lesotho.
SADC has been intervening, but the way we look at things, SADC is not that strict for implementation. The pace is so slow that if we can rely on its move, he will stay forever. But
so,
now, Basotho on their own have decided that he comes back home. True that SADC facilitator was around, he's the one who accepted him today, but that's what he can do. Nothing much, but what we can say, there were some suggestions that SADC has actually advised Lesotho to take, of which up to this far, nothing has been implemented.
So is it true that the opposition is going to introduce on February 24 a motion of no confidence in parliament?
Yes, we are waiting for the 24th and we are going to put in a motion of no confidence unless there is something that can be negotiated, which will lead the Prime Minister to have a clear exit, which is somehow human, because we still respect him as someone who has led this country for long.
Samuyele Unsekile is the Secretary General of former Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Thabane's All Basotho Convention Party. He was speaking with me from the Lesotho capital, Maseru. Today is Monday, February 13th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's petroleum minister says a lieutenant general who resigned from President Salva Kiir's government over the weekend did so because he was being investigated for corruption. Lieutenant General Thomas Cirilo, the country's deputy chief of staff for logistics, accused President Kiir and senior members of the army of ethnic cleansing. He also accused President Kiir of turning the army into a Dinka tribal army. But petroleum minister Ezekiel Lord Gatkuov says Lieutenant General Cirilo was being investigated for signing bad bills and buying personal houses.
Yes, the resignation is true. We have been briefed by the command of the SPLA. Well, he's being investigated by the army for corruption charges. You know, he's the deputy chief of staff for logistics. And the deputy chief of staff for logistics everywhere in the world, you are responsible for the logistics of the army. Then he has investigated for signing bad deals, issuing deals to different people who are not delivering, buying houses for himself in Nairobi and in different places. So he's being investigated. He has been absent from his duty since December last year, and now we are in February. The command of the army was zeroing in on him, and that's why he has to preempt the investigation by making a political statement. If you read the statement, it is not a resignation, it is a political statement. And army generals don't resign that way.
What do you make of his allegation that President Salva Kiir and the army, he said he resigned because of ethnic cleansing?
Well, it's just a political statement. Ethnic cleansing, where in Ye, there is no looming genocide. People are talking of looming genocide. The president was there recently. The first vice president was there also last year during Christmas and New Year, even in Equatoria. There's nothing that is happening. And I can assure you the president of the Republic, His Excellency General Salva Kiir Mayardit, and his first vice president, General Thabane Dengai, and the vice president, they are working as a team. Yemizwani Yiga, the vice president of the Republic of South Sudan, is from Equatoria. Why would he be the one to see it and the rest are not seeing it? It is just because he's being investigated and he's actually going to preempt the conclusion of the investigation on corruption charges by making a political statement.
Where are we in implementing the peace agreement? Because that is key. That's what's causing, I would say, some of the problems that we are experiencing. Where are we and what is the status of the former Vice President Riek Machar returning to the country?
Well, the implementation of the agreement is going very excellent. The president and the first vice president and the vice president and the whole cabinet. We are finished with the formation of the government, national government, the state government. Now they are formed. The parliament is formed. The national dialogue is launched by the president to reconcile the people of South Sudan and move on. For the country, we are moving on. Yes, there are some challenges here and there, some criminal activities that are happening in the pockets of the country.
Ezekiel Ogakov is South Sudan's petroleum minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. For the first time since the Somali state collapsed in 1991, the country says it plans to print its own banknotes this year. Bashir Issa Ali is governor of the Central Bank of Somalia.
So for the past 2 decades, Somalia did not print Somali shilling. But now you are optimistic that you will. Tell me about this process.
Okay, for Somalia, we will have find the resources to bring the money, as they told you, the currency. And then with the issue of the currency, we will have also changing the money in circulation so that for Somalia, we will have only in circulation reliable currency with good security features in throughout the country. And this will be, and then that Treasury also and the public will begin using the national currency as the national currency of the land. So that will be the beginning, for example, of a new era of monetary policy. This will imply also introducing some sort, for example, of foreign exchange mechanism, whereby when you have the Somali shilling, you must put in place also some sort of creating some mechanism to change the Somali shilling with other currency, international currency.
And what's the challenge? What's stopping you now from printing Somali currency? What's the challenge?
Actually, there were, from the beginning, two issues. One thing, for Somali, is the technical preparation of the central bank. This, we did a lot, for Somali, of efforts in collaboration and with the assistance of the international financial institutions, the World Bank and the IMF, basically, for Somali, and the World Bank and these financial institutions. So, for Somali, we have prepared all the issues or all the basic ground, for Somali, to prepare or put in place the technical requirements and so on. But then, for example, what remains is the basic issue, another basic issue, which is the financing, for example, of the currency to be issued. And this will require, for example, a huge amount of money that we don't have, but we expect the international community to assist in that issue. And one important venue, for example, to decide on this by the international community is the expected coming international donor conferences with Somalia in the coming months of April, May in London.
So are you saying that this year, sometime this year, you could print Somali currency, Somali shilling?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Bashir Issa Ali is the governor of the Central Bank of Somalia. He spoke with Haroon Maruf of the U.S. Somali Service. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omali.
Good morning, James. We begin with the Madagascar FA president, Ahmed Ahmed, whose ambition to dethrone Issa Hayatou as CAF president received a boost with the unanimous endorsement of all 14 members of the Council of Southern African Football Associations, COSAFA. Following a meeting in Johannesburg on Saturday, COSAFA stated it is unanimously endorsing the candidature of Madagascar FA president, Ahmed Ahmed, for CAF president in the upcoming CAF elections in Ethiopia. Staying with CAF news, the first leg matches of the 2017 CAF Champions League's preliminary round were brought to a close with 7 matches on Sunday. Tanzania's Young Africans put one foot in the next round with a comprehensive 5-1 away win over Comoros Ngaya Club, while Al Ahly Tripoli also took major strides towards qualification with a 3-1 away triumph over Ghanaian champions Wa All Stars. The rest of the matches were more closely contested. Cameroon's Cotton Sport defeated Atabara 2-0 at home, but will have a tough return trip to South Sudan next weekend. It's the same story for AC Leopards, Barak Young Controllers, and Gambia Ports Authority, all 1-0 home winners over USM, Stade Malien, and Siwe Sports, respectively. The 23 preliminary round ties will be completed with second leg matches next weekend of the 17th to the 19th of February. Now to some domestic football leagues across the continent. The Nigerian Professional Football League leaders Plateau United suffered their first loss of the season after they went down 2-1 at Akwa United. However, the Just Club remained top of the standings with 17 points from 8 matches, 3 points clear of closest rivals APS FC, who drew 2-2 at troubled Sunshine Stars. Elsewhere in South Africa, shocking scenes of violence played out at Loftus Versfeld Stadium in an APSA Premiership match between Mamelodi Sundowns and Orlando Pirates in the South Africa Premier League, as fans vented their fury with a pitch invasion as a rampant Mamelodi Sundowns took a 6-0 lead against Orlando Pirates on Saturday. The match was stopped with approximately 8 minutes remaining, and reactions have begun to trail the recent freeze of all transfers of allegiance between countries by the International Association of Athletics Federation, IWAF. The freeze is being introduced to halt the exodus of African athletes to other countries. Biligin Mekoya, General Secretary of Ethiopian Athletics Federation, says it will protect athletes from future exploitation. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Cape Town, South Africa. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
We stand up for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 13th. On this day in 1957, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was founded, with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as its first president. Its purpose was to fight against segregation and discrimination against blacks. Also on this day in 1923, the first black professional basketball team was organized. It was called the New York Renaissance. It went on to dominate for 25 years, not only black professional basketball, but also basketball in general. Did you know that an African-American, Dr. Charles Richard Drew, was the first person to develop the blood bank? His introduction of a system for the storing of plasma revolutionized the medical profession. Drew first utilized his system on the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific during World War II. In 1944, Drew was awarded the prestigious Swing Gun Award by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He taught and practiced surgery at Howard University until his death on April 1, 1950 from an automobile accident. On this day in 1635, the Boston Latin School, considered America's first public school, was opened in Boston. Black students were excluded from attending at the time. In 2016, it was estimated that about 9% of the students were black and declining. On this day in African history, in 1976, Nigerian head of state General Murtala Muhammad was assassinated during a failed military coup d'etat. He was succeeded by then Chief of Staff Olusegun Obasanjo, who completed his plan of an orderly transfer to civilian rule by handing power to Shehu Shagari on October 1, 1979. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 13th. Congratulations to Solomon Fesehaziam of Asmara, Eritrea, Ndara S. Mariara of Nairobi, Kenya, and Clement K. S. Tinet of Sekumono in Accra, Ghana. You are the winners of our February 10th question, which African-American wrote the novel The Color Purple? The answer, Alice Walker. Now here is our question for today, February 13th. Which African-American author wrote the novel Roots? Once again, which African-American author wrote the novel Roots? Send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. Get up, stand up. That's it for this Monday, February 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clarty and Ricky Stryak, along with our sports editor, Samson O'Malley, also our engineer Charles Hall. I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Next on Let's Talk, love and Valentine's Day in America. Do you have a Valentine? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing love and Valentine. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.